The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
President Joe Biden, he's about to begin this virtual meeting with his Chinese counterpart, Xi Jinping. This is the third time that President Biden has spoken with the president. Today's talks do come amid mounting tensions between the two nations. Taiwan, the South China Sea, and also trade policies are set to be on the agenda.
Our bilateral relationship evolves, seems to me, that will have a profound impact not only on our countries, but quite frankly, the rest of the world.
The White House had said in the lead-up to this meeting that President Biden was hoping to discuss ways to responsibly manage the competition between the US and China, as well as work together where interests align. The US and China did recently agree to cooperate on tackling climate change during the COP26 summit in Glasgow.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, you know, China, as you just heard in that piece, the president and Xi Jinping had gotten together. It was a three-hour meeting. China now has these hypersonic missiles, very hard for us to defeat. Of course, they pirated a lot of our technology. Can you imagine putting a nuclear warhead on those? I mean, the world's a very different place. These weapons, really plural, of mass destruction that are continually being developed, it raises moral questions. I don't feel more safe because there are more nuclear weapons. I don't. I honestly, you could argue the world is a less safe place. I get all kinds of press releases here at the show. You know, my producers and I, we get pitched topics all the time, right, from different entities on all sorts of subjects, some that never make it to air. We just got one from the Satanic Temple. Yeah, my producer Tom was like, "Why are they pitching us?" Right, the Satanic Temple, and it's good because we can keep tabs, you know, on really their mindset and what they're doing. But we've been getting press releases from a peace and justice group in Central New York State, and my team has largely ignored them. They've seen them, but they haven't really processed them until last week. They sent out a link and took them to a report of about 50 colleges and universities around the country that do work that's connected to nuclear weapons. And it's called Schools of Mass Destruction, and it comes from the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. The report places the schools into different categories. They have four of them, four different categories of cooperation with nuclear weapon labs. They've got these categories. One is direct management of the labs. The other is institutional partnerships with nuclear weapon labs. The third is research programs and partnerships. And the fourth is workforce development programs. All right. Now, most of the schools that are listed, they're publicly funded universities, or they're private, let's say, secular colleges and universities. So the report claims that their work with nuclear weapons goes against the purpose as institutions of higher learning, and there's really nothing that stops them from doing it. But there are two universities, and the reason I want to talk about it is for this particular reason. Two universities on that list whose presence makes you wonder, and it raises a question about whether or not they should be working to help advance this type of nuclear development. First one, Georgetown University, right? And that didn't totally surprise me. I remember when Barack Obama went and gave a talk at that particular university. They covered up all the crucifixes in the building and, you know, took down some of the religious imagery. And I'm thinking, you know, we are Catholics. That's our identity. The cross, right, of all things. Why would you cover that, right? So, okay, I'll assume that Georgetown might have went along with this. The other one was the University of Notre Dame, right? And both of these institutions, they have major programs on peace efforts, right? Major programs, you know, including Notre Dame's, you know, Kroc Center for International Peace Studies and Georgetown's Diplomatic School. It's Berkeley's Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs, the Institute for Women, Peace, and Security, and the program, of course, for Justice and Peace. And despite these peace programs, as I said, there's multiples, Notre Dame has reached programs and partnerships with nuclear labs going on. Georgetown has an academic partnership with Los Alamos National Laboratory. Should they? That's really the question. Should they? I invited today Well, Monsignor Stuart Sweatland, he served in our U.S. Navy for years. He is the president right now of Donnelly College in Kansas City, Kansas. I know you know him. He's been a regular voice and a host here on Relevant Radio for years. It's good to have him here with us. He also, just as a side note, serves as the executive secretary for the Fellowship of Catholic Scholars, and he is an expert on just war theory. We often talk to him about this topic, so I brought him back once again so that you can join the conversation and ask your questions, and we can get his insight. Monsignor, good afternoon.
Good to be with you, Drew. Thank you.
Thank you. You know, I want to talk about the morality of this. We can talk about weapons of mass destruction. We can talk about mutually assured, you know, destruction, and whether or not, you know, having nuclear weapons is in some respects a legitimate defense. So a lot to get into. But let's first start with the U.S. Let's talk about the United States. And it has an obligation, of course, to defend the homeland. It's and our interests. And we've made commitments to our allies. And while nuclear weapons aren't desirable, right? It's what we've got going on right now. So it makes sense for our country to work with universities to continue to develop and maintain them, as you see China developing hypersonic weapons and Russia now amping up its own arsenals and getting newer technology. Break this down for us. Help us to better understand this. I mean, is that an argument or a defense for us to continue to make more powerful, faster, and more destructive weaponry?
Well, as I have argued several times in print, I believe that nuclear deterrence, as it's currently practiced by the major nuclear powers in the world, is intrinsically immoral because it has as its core principle the conditional intention to disproportionately kill the innocent. People of another nation. In other words, it fails on just war principles, both for its indiscriminate nature, not discriminating between combatants and non-combatants, and its disproportion. No legitimate defensive goal can be achieved by the mass destruction of your enemies, innocent men, women, and children, and everything about them. So nuclear deterrence depends on an immoral choice, which we have conditionally made to do, and where all our soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, they're all trained, as I was when I served on nuclear subs, to make that choice their own by being willing to push the button or drop the bomb or whatever, launch the missile, whatever the weapon delivery system is. So we're training men and women to be part of a choice they've already made. All they're waiting for is the order to come through to do it. They've already made a choice that they will do it. So they've already made that conditional choice to disproportionately and indiscriminately kill the innocents of another nation. Now, I know most of them don't see it that way, but that's in fact the moral analysis of nuclear deterrence as it's currently practiced in the world. So in the big picture, this is an immoral structure. It's classically what St. John Paul II would talk about as a structure of sin. Now, getting down to the micro about these universities' involvement in that entire picture, if you start to drill down on their partnerships and their contracts with the government, a lot of this is a lot more innocent because it's the training of scientists. Some of it is the simulation of how we would survive an attack. It's computer simulation and things like that. You drill down on some of this, and these things are mostly legitimate. I'd have to, you'd have to know all the ins and outs, and hopefully they're doing an ethical review both at Notre Dame and Georgetown on these programs to make sure they're in no way cooperating with something that would be intrinsically problematic or evil.
Yeah, so to that point, I mean, the Catholic Church couldn't be clearer, I think, in her opposition to both the use, even the ownership of nuclear weapons. So why would two prominent Catholic schools develop partnerships with nuclear weapon labs? Isn't it better for them just to stay out of that business altogether?
Well, it is, if you do business in this world, and as a little bit Donnelly College, I have some relationships with both the Department of Energy and the Department of Defense. Now, it doesn't have anything to do with nuclear weapons. It's environmental things and the training of scientists, especially in my case, future scientists who are people of color and from the minorities and more women. These are things the government is funding. They want more minority scientists. They want more women scientists. I think that's good things. And so we contract with the Department of Defense, Department of Energy, also the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, in our environmental work and environmental science. So most universities and college have contact with the various parts of the federal government, either to do research or to support students who are going to go on to be leaders in those fields. And that's partly what Georgetown and Notre Dame is doing with these. Like, some of Notre Dame's work is on computer simulation. Some of it is on Stewardship Science Academic Alliance Center. That's training the next generation of scientists. Georgetown, by the way, you mentioned Los Alamos. It's actually Lawrence Livermore is where they have their partnership. And their scientists go out and do internships there. And there's more going on at these places than just nuclear weapons research. But they're obviously tied in with that. And we are this is the way things are funded in higher ed. These kinds of research contracts are normal. As you look at the map of these, they're literally all over the map. And as the group points out, the United States plans to spend, get this, $100,000 per minute over the next 10 years on nuclear weapons maintenance and development and protection and obviously deployment. So that's what it's costing the United States to do all this. And it's a structure that is highly problematic.
So morally speaking, let's just say, okay, nukes have been unleashed. You know, other nations now have it. Iran, you know, they're aggressive about getting them. I'm sure Israel and a lot of their neighbors are concerned. China has these hypersonic weapons, as I said. I mean, the face of warfare is really changing. Is there a moral obligation as a nation, now that these weapons are out there, to make sure that we develop the best, the fastest, the most effective type of weaponry, in addition to defense systems? Because our duty as a nation, those charged with governing, are to protect the people of that nation. Could there be an argument for saying, okay, you know, in order to fulfill that obligation, we need to make sure we have these weapons?
Well, you know, one of the things out of this report that, you know, was eye-opening to me was what Lisa Gordon Haggerty, who was then the National Nuclear Security Administrator, I think she still is, but she said in 2019 that the nuclear security enterprise is at the busiest it's been since the demands of the Cold War era. You know, everyone thought with the ending of the Cold War era in 1989 that these things would start to wind down, and we have greatly reduced the size and number of our nuclear weapons, both the United States and the Soviet Union. And that's a good thing. But we're at this period now where this is all gearing up again, partly because, as you point out, new generations of weapons are coming online. But also, I think some missteps that both sides have made. Russia has tested missiles in space, which used to be a taboo, not the least of which blowing things up in space leaves debris that could really ruin many of our satellites, not just ours, but others up there and, you know, rip through stations. And it's a real problem when you unleash debris into the atmosphere, above our atmosphere, excuse me, in orbit over the world. And then the fact that we can make smaller and smaller weapons that can be, you know, delivered in different ways, these new supersonic weapons. So, and of course, you've got other countries like North Korea and Iran and others who are either entering the nuclear club, if you will, or trying to enter the nuclear club. This is why Pope Francis has really said we need to go the other direction. We need to be disarming, and we need to be encouraging others to disarm. Now, John Paul II, and when he was Pope, he said deterrence was a way station on the way to total disarmament. And we could temporarily accept it only if and only if we were genuinely moving towards world disarmament. I'm afraid that many took that as an excuse to continue deterrence and continue the immoral structure that deterrence is built upon and not work towards the kind of, you know, total disarmament we should get to. Especially frightening is now we've cut down the speed in which decisions have to be made. And that, I think, is a recipe for mistakes, where I know from my time in the military, there were times that we had false indications that then the Soviet Union or its allies were doing things. And fortunately, there was time to verify before any actions were taken. With these kind of shorter-range missiles and supersonic weapons, it cuts the decision-making time down to so little that it makes it much easier for mistakes to be made.
Well, my guest today, Monsignor Stuart Sweatland. I'll tell you what, I only have him for a few more minutes. But if you want to join the conversation, let me open the phones. Love to hear, you know, your questions, thoughts. Maybe you've served in the military as well. Maybe you have a real problem with what you're hearing, too. That's fine. We'd love to engage with you. The number is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. You can call now and get in. Monsignor, I'm sitting back here, and I'm thinking about, you know, China and the U.S. and Russia and so many other places that are now, you know, they have nuclear weapons or want them. I can't imagine personally, and maybe it's a very naive perspective, I can't imagine any nation ever using these weapons. Let's say China fired a hypersonic missile at us or multiples, took out cities. We would retaliate. The loss of life, the destruction of nations, the impact on the global economy, on the world, it would just be unprecedented. Do you think nations would ever use nuclear weapons today or at some point in the future? I find it hard to believe that we would.
I would like to agree with you, Drew, but, you know, obviously we chose to do so as a nation at the end of World War II, dropping not just one but two devices on cities, targeting their populations. You know, along with the firebombing of Tokyo and the carpet bombing of Dresden, these were horrific acts for which we should be forever sorry and make amends. But other countries have shown under certain circumstances their willingness to do this. We came very close in 1973 to the Soviet bloc using nuclear weapons in the Middle East in support of their allies. Egypt, in that case. We obviously have someone who nobody can read what he will or won't do in North Korea. And of course, we have the Iranians saying that they will develop this material if we see it happening again and again. So I think we just have to recognize that's why we want to incentivize the other direction. Walking away like we did from chemical and biological weapons. And very few times has that threshold been violated since the banning of the use of chemical and biological weapons after World War I.
You know, from a spiritual perspective, too, I often think about this. You know, when you are in a relationship with God, you see life differently and you comport yourself very differently. I look at atheistic nations where there is no God, you know, and I wonder if they're more susceptible to figuring life is dispensable, you know, and would they be more likely to use a weapon like this if they thought, you know, they could win a war or if that was their only option? How does the God factor play into that? And as a nation, I think we're beginning to lose God more than ever. It's playing out. Grateful for Relevant Radio and for people like you and others that are speaking the truth and trying to bring God back to the culture. But the God factor in all this, in the mix, especially with these weapons, how does that play out in your own view? Have you ever thought about that?
Yes. Well, in particular for us in the United States, many of whom purport to be believers, both in the Christian Judeo ethic, let's just talk about that, you know, and Jesus is so specific on this, that we are not to be afraid. And I believe that our current nuclear strategy and the desire to modernize and update and spend this huge, grossly disproportionate amount of money on weapons we purport to never use, it comes out of fear. It comes out of a lack of trust, a lack of faith. It comes out of fear. And I'm afraid that that is not a good place for a nation state to be, to react out of fear. Now, we have duty to be vigilant, but to act out of fear, I think, leads to this kind of disproportionate reaction.
You know, to your point on the massive spending that will be done on this, I would love to see some sort of new technology or Star Wars program that could defeat a hypersonic weapon, you know, that could take out, you know, like we see this Iron Dome, something that's really effective, more effective than even those technologies. Maybe that's where our money should be going on defense, you know, as opposed to the offense, if you will. Although the Romans had that adage, if you want peace, prepare for war. And I think a lot of nations take that to heart, and that's why they build up their armaments. Let's go to the phones. We'll take a call.
But Thucydides said, even before the Romans, what was the cause of war was the rise of power in Athens and the fear that caused in Sparta. Or it was the other way around, the rise of power in Sparta and the fear that caused in Athens. I got to go back and check my Thucydides. But the point is that the building up of defense can itself destabilize. You know, that a lot of what happens, if you read Barbara Tuchman's great work on Folly, the August Folly of August 1914, and the march into World War One happened because of the arms race that the then superpowers were involved in. So I think it's important that we construct treaties and taboos that we don't break. Like, that's why I'm concerned that the Russians have broken the taboo of not using military weapons in space. I'm a little bit dubious about our space force and what we plan to do with that. I also think we should keep the taboo of the not use of nuclear weapons. I wish we would, along with others, pledge a no first use. That would, I think, go a long way towards defusing some of the dangerous where people think the other side is planning to use first. And then that will help the powerful nations, maybe can rein in the quote unquote rogue nations like North Korea or Iran by their saying, look, we're going to guarantee you won't be invaded, but you've got to give up this use of, you know, your precious resources that you should be using to feed your people on these kind of weapons.
All right. Ken's listening in Chicago. I only have a couple of minutes. Ken, good afternoon. Welcome.
Hi, Drew. Hello, Monsignor. So my question's around the conversation with regarding building nuclear weapons and driving towards disarmament. So given the recent discussion that I just heard on the radio, it seems as though it's relatively uncertain whether or not other nations will use nuclear weapons, and that's absolutely true. So given that fact, and given the fact that other nations are increasing their production of nuclear weapons, especially China and the Soviet and Russia, given those two facts, is there any more argument to be made that we shouldn't at least maintain our nuclear force or maybe even increase it?
Yes, I think there are arguments against it. At least I think we should move away from the structure of sin, where we threaten, either directly or indirectly, to destroy the innocence of the other, of our opponent. Two wrongs don't make a right. For us, not only must the end, some kind of stability or peace, be good, but the means for that end must be good. I think it's the Faustian bargain we made, beginning with the decision to violate the rules of armed conflict at the end of World War II, in our bombing decisions versus Germany and Japan, both in the way we use conventional weapons and fire bombs, as well as the nuclear weapons. It was the utilitarian move to say the end justifies the means that led to all kinds of immoralities afterwards. I think you can make a straight line, like Fulton Sheen did, between the decisions in World War II and the decision to allow abortion. Because once you devalue human life and say some human life can be taken because it serves a good end, then you come up with all kind of horrors. So we need to at least denounce the intent to kill the innocent disproportionately and indiscriminately of our opponents.
All right.
Hey, yeah, I agree with that, but just one more comment. So with your comments regarding bombing Tokyo, and Dresden's morally indefensible, but with regards to bombing Tokyo, if military targets are intertwined within the population, and your only method of eliminating these military targets are to bomb cities, and if you're going to end the war, what other option do you have?
Right. Well, if you read or listen to McNamara's own, and he was on the staff of Curtis LeMay, he helped make these decisions. The firebombing of Tokyo, for example, was not aimed at military targets. It was particularly aimed at the population of Tokyo. You know, they were attacking the homes of the men and women of because of how they were made. That's the weaponry they used, and they created a massive fire that killed probably more people in Tokyo than Hiroshima and Nagasaki combined. So our targeting of these cities was not targeting industries or military targets. It was targeting the city with the whole population. And McNamara admitted at the end of his life that if we had lost the war, he would have been rightfully tried as a war criminal, he and Curtis LeMay, because they made decisions that went outside the bounds of the laws of armed conflict.
Mm-hmm. But Ken, thank you for the call. I wish we could continue the conversation, but I am up against the clock. Monsignor, before I let you go, Kyle Rittenhouse, I'm sure you've been following that story as well. Legitimate self-defense. Let me give you an opportunity just to address that issue for those who are listening. When I come back, we're going to dive into the latest in that situation. So I'd love to get your take on that.
Well, the short take is I have not listened to the trial, so I cannot give a specific on the trial. You know, you'd have to have heard all the facts. What little I've been able to catch in reading the papers and from the clips you hear on the news, it seems like the argument for self-defense is there. But the bigger picture is, do we want to have a country where 17-year-olds are becoming, you know, picking up arms and becoming, you know, deputizing themselves and doing vigilante work, even right. if it's in a legitimate defense of property or whatever? We don't let 17-year-olds vote. We don't let 17-year-olds make a decision about picking up a beer and having it for good reason. Right. They're not mature enough to do that. We don't want 17-year-olds picking up AK-15s and going into the streets. So,
do you want an 18-year-old doing that,
Monsignor? That's the bigger problem I have. The spirit of vigilanteism seems to be there in our society, and it's a dangerous
thing. Take the age out and say he's 18. He's an adult. Does that change things?
No, I don't think so. No, we deputize people. Yes, we train people. We have police. We have National Guard. There's reason that they're specially trained, especially in understanding when and where deadly force can be used. Yes, you have a right to self defense of your home and hearth. That's the Castle Principle, and I believe in it. But I think it's the breakdown of civilization. It's what separates us from the barbarians, the rule of law, when people start to take the law into their own hands.
Monsignor, thank you. I'd have to have you back. We'll talk more about it. The jury is deliberating, maybe tomorrow or some point in the future we can catch up on that as well. But thank you for your time. It's always great to talk with you. Appreciate your contribution today.
Thanks, Drew.
It's Monsignor Stuart Sweatland. As I often like to say a prayer for him, too. Great man and a lot of wisdom. When we come back, we will talk about the Rittenhouse trial. Stay with me. That conversation straight ahead. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, thanks for joining me. It's great to be with you today. I don't know if you have followed the Kyle Rittenhouse trial. It's continuing. I watched some of the prosecution and defense the other day just to get a feel for what's going on. Kenosha, Wisconsin is a relatively small town. And boy, it was a mess. You got to remember all this happened right after the death of George Floyd. And we saw cities across the country being looted, vandalized, burned, innocent people really being injured. And of course, Kyle Rittenhouse is on trial right now. He went down there. He was only 17 years old. Went down there with an AR-15 and brought his medical bag and wanted to go ahead and try to protect businesses and help some people who were injured. It ended up going bad. He ended up shooting and killing a couple of individuals and is now on trial for this. And it's really a trial of self-defense. The jury is deliberating as we speak. Earlier in the afternoon, the jury asked for and they received copies of all the instructions that the judge issued them. It's 36 pages of instructions, which, gosh, that's got to be hard to follow. I hope they have somebody who's pretty good at leading them. Rittenhouse, of course, is on trial for killing two people. He injured one other and was trying to, again, just keep, he's trying to help. As you know, the governor of Wisconsin, Governor Evers, didn't send out the National Guard. And there was this mindset at the time not to do anything, to stand down with the military, with the police forces, and people just took over. I saw video footage of people throwing, you know, setting restaurants and businesses and places on fire. It was just anarchy. It was terrible. I had a real problem with it. But we're getting a lot of testimony now in this case and the evidence. It was pretty clear that during very critical moments, it seems, at least from the evidence and what the defense is saying, that he acted entirely in self-defense and only shot at people when he believed that his life was in an imminent danger. He went to turn himself into the police, who basically told him to go away. He went down the streets, his hands up, and was trying to flag people down. And of course, it was chaos. The police didn't know what he was doing. And, you know, of course, later he was arrested. The prosecution in the case, from what I've heard from other pundits and experts, other attorneys, they're not doing so well. The prosecutor, a guy named Thomas Binger, didn't do him any did himself any favors yesterday either. Did you see the picture when he picked up this weapon, the Rittenhouse's weapon, this AR-15? It was as an exhibit. He didn't check the action to see if there was a bullet in the chamber. He put his finger actually on the trigger, and he lifted this powerful weapon and aimed it right at the jury. Now, I understand the dramatic effect of that. Looking down the barrel of a gun can really be eye-opening. Anybody hear this movie Rust? Have you heard about Alec Baldwin and the mistake that happened? Those guns were supposed to be filled with blanks. There's people who are supposed to have a series of checks and balances to make sure that those weapons were empty. That would freak me out a little bit. All three of those actions that Binger did violated basic gun safety measures, and some have even suggested he violated the law by doing it, but who knows? I mean, the question, of course, is how the jury is going to respond to all the evidence that has come up. 30 witnesses have been called. It's also going to be curious, personally, just to see how they respond to the pressure that they're going to feel as protesters now gather outside the courthouse in anticipation of the verdicts. And again, you know, the coverage on this. One other thing, and David Koppel's here, and we're going to get it into him and get his take on this. You're welcome to join, too. I had heard, I think my wife told me this morning, so she's my source. I can't validate this, but it was either her or somebody else that told me that the media coverage on this, I think some conservative media outlets, they ran the whole trial. You heard the prosecution as well as the defense. It was either MSNBC or CNN, one of those outlets, only ran the prosecution. And I'm thinking, can you imagine that if you get like no coverage except one side of the story? And let's say that he is found innocent, but you only heard the prosecution saying this guy should be found guilty. Suddenly, in the mindsets of a lot of people, there's justification for the rioting, the burning, the looting that's going to ensue. A lot to unpack here, a lot to talk about. And as I said, David Koppel, who's been a good friend of the show, is back again. He's the author of that book, Morality of Self-Defense and Military Action in the Judeo-Christian Tradition. Find him online at his website, Dave Koppel. That's KOPEL.org. Twitter at Dave Koppel. Of course, he is also a research director of the Independence Institute in Denver, and it's good to talk with him. David, thank you for your time. Always good to have you back. Good afternoon.
Great. Thank you for having me.
So, Professor, yesterday the judge decided to drop this illegal possession of a weapon charge that was against Kyle Rittenhouse. Let's talk about what's going on in the trial and your take on what is now unfolding. There's those particulars of the trial, then there's the big picture of it as well. How do you think the prosecution and the defense are doing and the judge? Let's talk about the key players in this thing.
I'd say the judge has made some rulings that benefited the defendant, like the one you just mentioned, and he explained that as he studied the law, the particular Wisconsin statute about illegal possession of a weapon by a minor over and over and over, he couldn't really make any sense of it as to, you know, how it would apply to this case. Rittenhouse's gun, in as far as Wisconsin law is concerned, is a standard long gun. You know, and there was nothing special about it that would make it subject to extra regulations, such as having a barrel under 16 inches or something like that. On the other hand, he allowed the prosecution to introduce a very sketchy and highly edited video, which even the person who'd created the amplified video said, by blowing up the size, you introduce into it pixels that are not part of the original. And it's all these non-original pixels that the prosecution is now hanging its hat on, claiming that the Rittenhouse had his right-handed, and you normally would shoulder a gun on your, if you're right-handed, on your right shoulder, right, that he was putting on his left shoulder and pointing it at somebody, which seems highly unlikely. But anyway, the judge allowed that evidence in, and that's without that, the prosecution would have almost no case at all.
So is there any case at all for him being found guilty on any of the charge filed against him? Well, how do you read this? You think he's going to, I mean, the deliberation's underway now, so I thought it would have been a pretty quick case, but maybe not. How do you read it?
I'd say based on, well, over, there's a good website on some of these issues called Legal Insurrection, which is run by a Cornell University law professor, and they've had Andrew Branca, who's a very experienced criminal defense lawyer and was watching the whole trial and has been commenting on it. And Branca's done lots of self-defense cases and had good insights. And his view was that the defense's closing argument was very poor yesterday, even though they'd been doing fairly well up until that. So I suppose anything can happen. But I guess what I would say, I've not watched the trial minute by minute, but I followed it closely, and to me it seems very hard to get a conviction at a level of beyond a reasonable doubt. The first guy that Rittenhouse shot was a guy who had previously, he was, and by the way, all the people he shot were white, so that this was no racial issue,
right,
although some of the media tried to make it one. Was a guy who had previously said, let's kill Rittenhouse, let's kill this guy when we get him alone. Later, Rittenhouse was alone as he was trying to put out a dumpster fire. And this guy, Rosenblum, who had just recently been released from jail and was also convicted for having sex with a minor previously, was mentally disturbed and was off his meds, and ran at Rittenhouse screaming and got so close that he grabbed the muzzle of Rittenhouse's rifle, at which point Rittenhouse shot him in lawful defense. Then some other guy came up. Rittenhouse was on the ground, kicked him in the head, ran away. Another guy, Rittenhouse shot at him, and he fled, but nobody was hit. And then another guy came up while Rittenhouse was on the ground and started beating him on the head with a skateboard, which is not a deadly weapon per se, but when you're hitting somebody on the head with it, it sure is. And, you know, if you're experienced with skateboards, you know they can be pretty heavy. So Rittenhouse shot that guy, and then a third guy walks up to Rittenhouse with his hands in the air, and then when Rittenhouse is distracted for a second, pulls out a handgun, points it at Rittenhouse, and Rittenhouse shot that guy and injured his arm. So that, and the prosecution in its closing really egregiously misstated the law of self-defense. For example, saying if you bring a gun to a situation, then you lose your right to self-defense. Or saying that if somebody's attacking you with a handgun and you've got a rifle, since a rifle's better than a handgun, you're not supposed to be, you shouldn't even be afraid of the handgun since you've got the better gun. And I suppose that would be true if you were shooting at each other from 300 yards away, because a handgun doesn't have that kind of range and a rifle does. But when you're a few feet away, either one is a very deadly weapon at short range.
You're not kidding. My guest today is Professor David Koppel. And I'll tell you, I'll take some calls when we come back. I'm going to take a short pause here so you can get in if you want to join us. The number here is 888-914-9149. I'm approaching one of the final segments of my day with you, taking a look at the Rittenhouse trial, self-defense, the law, what's unfolding, and what might happen when the verdict comes out. You can get in. 888-914-9149. Stay with us. Our conversation continues right after this. Hi, Drew Mariani here. Hey, I am traveling to the Holy Land in February with our underwriting sponsor, Nativity Pilgrimage. Information is available at relevantradio.com/Holy Land. That's relevantradio.com/Holy Land.
This is the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio and on the Relevant Radio app.
Hey, great to be here with you today. A lot going on in the world, putting our finger on the pulse of what is happening with the Kyle Rittenhouse trial and zooming out, taking a bigger look at this, too. I remember in March of last year, remember with the George Floyd situation, we had what happened in Kenosha. We saw the camp set up in Seattle. I mean, all across the country, there was a lot of chaos. And now we see real attitude changes in a lot of different states now. They're beginning to refund police, not defund them. In March of last year, I was struck by something I had seen. The feds processed about a million background checks. A million background checks. That was just in 1 week, right? And that kind of volume was continuing. Background checks went up to like 1.2 million. That was March. I think the Rittenhouse case took place in August of 2020. A lot of the people who purchased those guns, and this was the New York Times who reported on it back then, and they said a fifth of all Americans bought guns last year. For the first time, they were gun owners. Many justified buying the guns. They saw what happened, like in the streets of Kenosha and in other places where robbing and looting and violence were taking place and the police were standing down. Half were women, right? A fifth were Black. A fifth were Hispanic. So it wasn't just white guys out there buying guns. All those purchases, nearly 40% of American households now own guns. And that is a very significant increase. But it raises questions, too, about defense. And one thing I want to be clear on is that, you know, we never want to champion vigilante justice. And, you know, Kyle went in there to help, Kyle Rittenhouse. He wanted to protect businesses. He was young. I think he was ideal, and things really went wrong. You never want to be trigger happy. You never want to kill anyone. Self-defense, the catechism is clear. It says, you know, killing a human being is always a grave issue. It should never be taken lightly, right? Never. But the catechism does go on to explain the fundamental principle of morality is love and, you know, preservation of oneself. And the doctors of the church, the magisterium, they made it very clear that self-defense is not only a right, in some cases, it is a duty. It is a duty. A lot of people are saying that's what's on trial right now in this Rittenhouse case. And I've invited the author of a book called The Morality of Self-Defense and Military Action, the Judeo-Christian Tradition, Professor David Koppel, to join us today. And Professor, I'm grateful for your work. Do you read what happened with Kyle? And then we'll jump into the phones here. As legitimate self-defense, do you think this is a trial about self-defense?
Certainly it is, and especially the way the prosecution's handled the case of grossly misstating what the Wisconsin law of self-defense really is to try to make it much narrower than the law currently is. And remember, this isn't a case, and here's where I think some of the prosecution or the defense argument was maybe went wrong. It was this whole thing about, you know, implicitly about the bad guys who were very bad guys, the rioters, the arsonists, and the criminals who took advantage of what some other people were doing, which was peacefully protesting about a police use of force. And whether they were right or wrong about that particular case, of course they had every right to protest, but using that situation to then come in and start looting and destroying and attacking people and burning buildings down, versus, you know, Kyle, the good guy who was defending the community. He didn't live there, but his father did, and he had plenty of family there. That is one way to look at it, but I think the more particular legal way to look at it is when somebody says they acted in self-defense, you're not supposed to decide, oh, is he a good guy, bad guy, whatever, you know, what do you think of him overall? You're just supposed to say, did the prosecution disprove self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt? And I think if the jury stays focused on that issue, he would have a very good chance of an acquittal.
All right, we'll go to the phones. Denise has been waiting. She's in Chicago. She's got a question for you. Denise, good afternoon.
Thank you. I agree. This is a case of self-defense. If you watch the trial and you listen to the testimony, it was pretty clear that he acted in self-defense, and the videos proved it. However, I don't agree with what Kyle did. Although he had the right, he was 17. He was allowed in the state of Wisconsin to own a rifle. He went to his father's house. He didn't bring the rifle with him. There's a little nugget that the jury, that the defense attorneys didn't bring out that he should have. But who failed Kyle Rittenhouse? Kyle Rittenhouse was 17. He had the guts to want to go in and protect his community that he knew and grew up in, even though his mother lived in Antioch in Illinois. That's 20 miles away. It's not like he went from California to Kenosha. He saw this destruction going on in his community for 3 days straight with celebrities bailing people out from burning and looting. And he took an adult position of being a defender. Where were the adults in that situation? The adults failed him. The adults failed him. He was 17. When he broke down in that courtroom, I can't imagine that one parent didn't feel that emotion from that child at 17. He was terrified of what was going on, but yet he was running away from the violence, not turning around and shooting at it. He was acting in self-defense, and I'm worried that the jury's taking so long.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation, Denise, because I thought if indeed they made their case for self-defense, it would not have taken this long. But as I pointed out, there's a list of 36 instructions that they've got to go through. So what do you make of the time, Professor, that this is taking? You heard her take. She says, you know, Kyle was failed by the adults around him. Give me your thoughts and her comments, if you would.
Well, and starting with, let's start the list at the top of the failures is Governor Evers of Wisconsin, who has a duty to maintain the rule of law and did nothing and let the rioters run wild and cause all their mayhem and their burnings. And they did it for an entire day and night. And then they were coming back for more. The mayor was essentially telling them, gave him permission to burn by not putting up any responsible adults like the Wisconsin National Guard to suppress this violent crime spree.
All right, we have a few moments left. Let me grab another quick call here to Santa Fe, New Mexico. Patrick is listening. Patrick, you're on the air. Good afternoon.
Yeah, Professor Koppel, to the point. There was a directed verdict motion made just before the closing argument, and we see a jury that's already likely been intimidated or at least attempted to intimidate them and mispracticed by the prosecution. What do you think the judge might do? Certainly he wants to see a verdict come in, but how do you think he might handle that directed verdict given what you have already said about the evidence on self-defense?
It's not impossible he could rule in favor of that after the jury comes back, although I think judges overwhelmingly prefer to just let the jury have its say. There's also the issue about how long the jury is taking. Sometimes those things turn out to be right, where the jury has a quick and easy time getting to a not guilty result. But you've got 12 people in there, and they do represent sort of necessarily a cross section of the community with different views and backgrounds and everything. So they may have to discuss things. We could be at a 10-2, for example, one way or the other, and the jury is doing the proper thing and continuing the discussion and letting the two have their say, and the other 10, in whatever direction, are talking about how they see the evidence. So it's not always true that the timing tells you how long it's the timing predicts what the result will be.
That's so true. Well, I'll tell you what, I've got to leave it right there. My apologies to Dolores and Phoenix and everyone else. I only have about a moment left for you, Professor. And your book, I always try to get people plug into that, The Morality of Self-Defense and Military Action. I think it's a good read, The Judeo-Christian Tradition. I'm assuming that's available at all major bookstores online. What's the best way to connect?
One would hope, but yeah, any bookstore you go to would be happy to special order it for you, and they can have it in a few days. But you can also just buy it immediately online from Barnes & Noble or Amazon.
All right, and be sure to follow him on Twitter. It's at Dave Koppel, Koppel spelled K-O-P-E-L. His website too, davekoppel.org. Professor, thank you. We will catch up again. I'm always grateful for your insights.
Great. Thank you very much.
All right. I'm out of time for the day. I want to thank you, too, for allowing me to be part of your afternoon. Kale Clark is coming up. I want to say Kyle Clark. Kale Clark is coming right up straight ahead. All right. I'll be back tomorrow to give you another look at life you're not going to find anywhere else. Be sure to tune in and say a prayer for me. I will remember you tonight as I spend a little bit of time with the Lord. Until then, have a great day.